Welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live with Tim Franks in London and me, James Kamarasamy, in Milwaukee. We are coming to you today from Solly's Grill. It's a popular haunt in the biggest city in the Midwestern state of Wisconsin, one of the seven or so states likely to decide tomorrow's US presidential election. Solly's speciality is that gooey Wisconsin delicacy, if that's the right word, the butter burger. In front of me, orders for it coming in thick, very thick and fast. Now, both Republican nominee Donald Trump and Democrat Kamala Harris have been to Milwaukee in recent days, although they've sent their running mates to Wisconsin for the final dash at the end of this extraordinary campaign, and one in which more than 78 million Americans have already cast early votes. Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail by Hunter S. Thompson, that classic of US election reportage, is now more than 50 years old, but its title feels pretty apt this year. There is plenty of fear and no small amount of loathing in the atmosphere during the final hours before polling stations open. We'll have more from Wisconsin later on in the program. First, though, let's hear about the final hours of campaigning in other swing states. At a rally in Reading, Pennsylvania, Donald Trump attacked his opponent, Kamala Harris, accusing her of the most egregious betrayal of the American people by any leader in history.
She's violated her oath of office. She's eradicated our sovereign border and unleashed an army of gangs and criminal migrants from prisons and jails, insane asylums and mental institutions, from all around the world, from Venezuela and the Congo in Africa, stealing countless American lives. And these are rough customers that are coming.
Well, immigration is an issue that plays very well with voters on the Republican side in particular. We'll have more about that later in the program. For her part, Kamala Harris began the day in Joe Biden country. Remember him? Scranton, Pennsylvania, at a canvassing event. She told Democratic Party faithful to remind potential voters that Americans have more in common than what divides them.
And so the way I've always been thinking about our campaign in these next 24 hours is, as we are getting out to vote, as we are canvassing, let's be intentional about building community, about building community, about building coalitions, about reminding people we all have so much more in common than what separates us. There's power in that.
Kamala Harris there. Well, Donald Trump was also in Pennsylvania on Sunday at a rally in Lititz. He wheeled out the sort of unproven allegations about election fraud that we've heard from him in previous campaigns. He even mused about journalists being shot. Our correspondent Tom Bateman was there.
This is a man's world, is playing on the PA system. The crowds are in there, thousands. There's a giant picture of Donald Trump is beamed down from a big screen, and there's a low-hanging morning sun beaming down on us in rural Pennsylvania here as a helicopter hovers above, about to come in Donald Trump. When did you get out of bed this morning?
Got out of bed at 5:30. She woke me up.
Happy to be here?
Yeah. Pretty cool that he's coming to all the small towns and showing that he cares.
What will Donald Trump do for you?
I think he'll make life easier. Taxes, groceries, everyday living. Be able to survive.
Donald J. Trump!
He started with the policy substance, the economy, which, along with immigration, is Trump's top theme, targeted especially here in the Rust Belt.
You like it better now or 4 years ago? Well, I ask it a different... You like it better now or 4 years ago? And I've come today with a message of hope for all Americans. With your vote on Tuesday, I will end inflation. I will stop the invasion of massive numbers of criminals coming into our country. Thank you very much, Kamala and Joe. And I will bring back the American dream, and we'll bring it back stronger than ever before. But this is all you need to know. Kamala broke it, and we will fix it, and we're going to fix it fast.
The former president then veered way off the teleprompter. For 20 minutes, he assailed the election process in this critical swing state, 2 days before millions of voters vote. He claimed without evidence that a days-long count, which is likely in Pennsylvania, given how tight the race is, will be a sign of fraud. He said people were trying to steal the election from him.
Can you imagine? They spend all this money on machines, and they're going to say, we may take an extra 12 days to determine. And what do you think happens during that 12 days? What do you think happens?
They're cheating, shout some in the crowd.
Bunch of crooked people. These are crooked people.
Well, there's a crowd now spilling outside of the runway and the aircraft hangar beyond the barricades here, and a big screen outside. Some of the loudest cheers going up when Donald Trump has called the press, the Democrats, and the opinion polling all corrupt.
And I have this piece of glass here, but all we have really over here is the fake news, right? And to get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news. And I don't mind that so much, because I don't mind.
What did you think of when Donald Trump was saying that the election process here is being rigged, that Democrats are cheating?
It is. And it was 4 years ago.
Can I ask what you thought of the rally?
It's great. Great. Love, companionship. Everybody was there for the same reason, for a good outturn on Tuesday. And I think God gave us our modern-day Moses to deliver us from these crooks.
The two candidates have poured time and money into campaigning in Pennsylvania. For Harris, who many voters say they still don't know enough about, the challenge has been acute, pulling even with Trump since the summer, but unable to break the deadlock. In the town of Harrisburg, the local Democrats rally their volunteers. They know a margin of just a few tens of thousands of votes could swing the election here either way.
Well, I think it's going to be a very close race for the Senate race and the presidential.
Bob Casey, a Pennsylvania senator, is running for election for the fourth time. For fellow Democrats in Washington who forced Joe Biden off the ticket 3 months ago, they may have hoped their gamble would have produced clearer numbers by now.
Do you regret that you're not further ahead in the opinion polling?
I can't tell you how much I've been impressed by the progress that Kamala Harris made from July, when President Biden decided not to run, till today. Because at that time, both here in Pennsylvania, I think a lot of other places around the country, we were in a deficit position. She's made up that deficit. Now it's pretty much a dead heat. But I think the momentum's on her side and on our side. A lot of that momentum has to do with what's happening here today.
On the faces of some canvassers, you can see the exhaustion. The mood is uncertain.
My name is Kat Knapp.
How are you feeling about the election?
Wow. Well, that's a good question. I wish I could tell you. I have actually turned my feelings off at this point. It's all about less worry, more doing. So really right now, it's just about the heads down work needed and voter engagement needed to win the election.
The opinion polls in Pennsylvania suggest that concerns about the candidate's character, especially Trump's, are less important to many voters than a feeling that they're simply on their side. This is a campaign of the visceral over the practical to decide whose world wins.
Tom Bateman reporting from Pennsylvania. Well, Carmen Russell Sluchansky is a politics reporter with WHYY Public Radio in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania. I asked him to remind us why the state matters so much in this election.
Pennsylvania is the largest out of these swing states, with 19 electoral votes out of the 270 that either candidate needs to actually win this election. Also, Pennsylvania is very, very representative of the United States as a whole. You know, we have very urban areas such as Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. We have a lot of farmland, rural areas, and so forth. And there's also what we call the Rust Belt, which are, you know, very industrial areas, especially from, you know, from years ago, you know, especially in western Pennsylvania. And it's also, you know, pretty evenly split right down, you know, along party lines. An incredible record as far as determining who the next president is. The Pennsylvania has gone along with the person who, you know, candidate that ended up winning the general election, something like 48 out of 59 of the last elections.
Yes, all roads lead to Pennsylvania. What about the main themes then? What are the two candidates really emphasizing on this final day?
Yeah, so a lot of that was pointed out in your reporting that I was just listening to. It really depends on who you talk to. If you talk to Republicans, immigration is one. Obviously, immigration is not as impactful here in Pennsylvania, where you are not a border state and so forth. And if I ask people, well, how does it impact you? They speak in more grand terms about border security. Also, if you're Republican, you really care about the, you know, about prices. Prices are higher. We've had, although inflation has been coming down, prices are definitely higher than they were, you know, just a few years ago. If you talk to Democrats, a lot of it's about abortion, reproductive health rights. And then another thing you hear among Democrats a lot is about what they perceive as a threat to democracy, the threat to democracy that they say Donald Trump presents if he is reelected.
And in terms of what the candidates are doing in the cities where you are, for example, what are you seeing?
Yeah, well, I mean, we actually have both candidates in our general area even today. Kamala Harris, this is like her 18th trip since she became the nominee. She had made other trips before she came. So it's been incredible the number of times that both have been here. Kamala Harris has spent a lot of time in Philadelphia. Now, Philadelphia is a very Democratic city. Philadelphia will vote for Kamala Harris. But one of the concerns I think that Democrats have is that Philadelphia voters, Philadelphia Democrats, actually come out, that they come out to vote. So that's one of the reasons why, well, it's the reason really, that she's making her last argument here tonight, where she's going to have, you know, some celebrities, including Lady Gaga and so forth. That's really to get that vote out. But you also see, on the Donald Trump side, you see him kind of spending a lot of time in places like Bucks County, Berks County and other places where he thinks that not only can he get, some of his, more hardcore Republicans just to make sure that they come out, but also to persuade undecided voters. They're both also spending a lot of time right now in Puerto Rican areas to try to, like, you know, take capitalize on those comments that were made in Madison Square Garden.
Carmen Russell Sluchansky, politics reporter with WHYY Public Radio in Philadelphia, on the importance of Pennsylvania. Just another quote from Donald Trump today to bring you. If we win Pennsylvania, we win the whole ball of wax. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service.
And coming up on the program, plenty more from James Kamarasamy in Wisconsin. We'll also be heading to the Lebanese city of Nabatea, which is almost deserted as people have left to avoid fighting. We'll hear from one man who did decide to stay, but was then hit during an Israeli strike when he was trying to bring food to a neighbour.
It was all black, smoke everywhere. I took about 1 minute. Then I started to recognize what is around me. So my friends started talking to them and I knew they were still alive.
That report from Ola Guerin in southern Lebanon coming up in about 20 minutes. Our main headline this hour, as we've been hearing, on the eve of the US presidential election, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are setting out their final appeal to voters in the crucial swing states.
You're listening to NewsHour with Tim Franks in London and me, James Kamarasamy, in one of those swing states, Wisconsin. More on the US election now and the potential consequences of Donald Trump's now familiar claims that it will be stolen. One of the many unique aspects of this year's vote is the fact that one of the candidates still doesn't publicly acknowledge that he lost 4 years ago. Well, after what happened in 2020, the Trump-backed Stop the Steal movement and the eventual attack by some of his supporters on the US Capitol building, more attention than ever is being paid to the voting and the vote counting. As chair of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, Democrat Ann Jacobs is responsible for the smooth and secure running of everything in this state. That position rotates between the two parties every couple of years, and she actually held it 4 years ago as well. So, how was that experience?
It was jarring and a bit surreal. 2016, Donald Trump won Wisconsin. We had a statewide recount. He still won Wisconsin. We had a Democratic chair of the Elections Commission who certified his election, and that was what we did. And there were some issues, there always are in every election, but it wasn't anything extraordinary. 2020 happens, and everything is different. The attacks on the election system, the attacks on democracy, we had never seen anything like that before, certainly leading into January 6th and the attacks on the Capitol. And I think that has really changed how we look at elections here in Wisconsin.
You were in the eye of the storm then. You were in this role in 2020. What was that experience like for you personally?
There were moments that it was concerning. I remember specifically one person posted a photograph of my home and on social media and said, I wonder where her children go to school. So that was the sort of level of vitriol and the like, and there were others that were worse, that really changed how we look at this process. At the same time, the importance of being a part of this process and administering it fairly in accordance with the law is essential for our democracy. And so those other matters notwithstanding, we have to move forward.
Notwithstanding your awareness of what that could mean for you personally, threats you're talking about here.
Yes, and they've continued.
Can you tell us more?
Oh, sure. One of the local conspiracy theorists put up a photograph of a guillotine and said that the chief elections official, Megan Wolf of our agency, and I should be questioned whether we should be guillotined. That was a nice one.
What are you expecting, given this atmosphere you're describing? What are you expecting on election night and beyond?
I think some of it is going to depend on how the numbers shake out across the country. If we're seeing reports from the East Coast, which closes their elections much earlier than we do, showing a significant Harris win or lead, I think that may take some of the sails, wind out of the sails here in Wisconsin for the people who want to attack the process. That said, I am anticipating a lot of folks trying to interfere with the process during the day on November 5th by making spurious challenges against voters, against forms, against envelopes. So I am expecting that. I hope to be wrong. I'm always optimistic, but I certainly am expecting that behavior.
That was Ann Jacobs, chair of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. I've also been speaking to Mick Mulvaney. He was the White House chief of staff to Donald Trump between 2019 and 2020. He actually resigned from the administration. He was in a different role at that point on January the 6th, but he has voted for his former boss this time. So does he think he could win?
Sure, I think he can win. He could lose. In theory, I suppose they could tie as well. It seems as if both campaigns are sort of stumbling to the finish line. The Harris closing argument about Trump being a fascist, I don't think is getting much traction. And Trump continues to sort of wander all over the place as opposed to beat the issue of how people are, you know, were better off when he was president. So they're both almost looks like they're trying to give it away, but someone is going to win on Tuesday, I would expect.
Well, the other thing Donald Trump has been saying, and we've heard this before, is this is going to be a stolen election. Does that worry you?
You know, without the data point of 2020, it wouldn't bother me. It would be, I'd see it as hyperbole and just sort of him talking. But with a data point of 2020, yeah, I'm a little concerned about it. There have been, I have no difficulty with lawsuits surrounding our elections. I think they're healthy. In fact, if anything, they help increase the credibility of the election outcomes when people have a chance to bring what they consider to be evidence to the courts and say, look, this is what happened, et cetera, et cetera. Well, so I have no difficulty in principle with lawsuits, and I think there'll be lawsuits on the Republican and Democrat side. I don't like the idea of anyone who loses not losing gracefully. I know there's been a lot of attention on what happens if Trump loses. I think there should be some attention on what happens if Harris loses as well. But either way, I hope that that once we have a clear winner, that the loser will concede gracefully.
That rhetoric, it's not disqualifying for you. I mean, that on top of the very violent language that he uses on the stump. And I know, and I've spoken to Republicans who say, look, there's stuff going on both sides. But he is empirically unique in using the language of shooting, of bloodshed, of the fake media, perhaps taking a shot in front of him. Is that not disqualifying?
Yeah, no, it's not, because it's not right. And look, I've been critical of the man's style from the very beginning. Again, when you're the chief of staff, you have to be critical of the boss. You're the one person who gets paid to be critical of the president of the United States. But the comments you mentioned that, referring to the headlines here were that he said that Liz Cheney should go before a firing squad. That's false. The comments.
Well, hold on a second. Sorry. I just referred to the language. I didn't give you the quote.
Yeah.
You would not quibble with the fact he has talked about bloodshed, about shooting,
and the blood,
even if the words have been distorted. I'm talking about the tenor
bloodshed.
Of the.
Take mm-hmm. bloodshed for an example. I mean, there's going to be bloodshed in the automotive industry. Is that disqualifying language for a president of the United States? I don't think so. Look, again, the man's style, I know, rubs a lot of people the wrong way, including me some of the time. But I think he's become a caricature of himself by the misrepresentation of some of his statements in the media. So you ask him if it's disqualifying. It's like, no, his language is not disqualifying.
That was Mick Mulvaney, who was White House Chief of Staff to Donald Trump between 2019 and 2020.
James, I'm struck by, I mean, maybe it's an obvious thing to say, but I mean, you've covered so many US elections. Just some of the language, some of the tone around this, it's not just, I mean, it's about the strength of the democratic process, but it's also the way both candidates are talking about the future of the country. I mean, have you heard language like this before?
Well, you know, Donald Trump has used this language before in the past, of course, but I think what's different now is when you talk to people who support either side, they feel nervous for different reasons. They often feel as though they're living in different realities, different sets of facts that they believe. You know, you hear Kamala Harris talk about unity, but, you know, Republicans mistrust her in many ways as much as Democrats distrust Donald Trump. I mean, we did have here in Solly's Grill a little while ago one example of perhaps how people can come together. We actually met a couple. He has voted for Donald Trump, although she thought she'd persuaded him not to. It didn't turn out that way. But she's a big Harris supporter. And they say, look, we don't talk about politics at home. We just don't. But they somehow managed to live under the same roof. And they thought, well, maybe we can be a bit of an example for America. But as they go into this election, lots of nerves, lots of anxiety. It does feel like a country very much on the edge. You are listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'll be back with more later on in the programme.
Welcome back to NewsHour. In Paris, a second trial has opened into a murder which shocked France. Seven men and a woman are accused of, among other things, driving a misinformation campaign which led to a teenaged Islamist beheading a teacher in 2020. Samuel Paty, who taught history at a school near Paris, had displayed cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad during a class discussion on freedom of expression. Alexandra Kouchner is a journalist and political analyst.
The second trial looks into the eight adults who were prosecuted for terrorist conspiracy. This includes the two people responsible for spreading fake online information, the friends of the assassin who were with him when he bought the knife used in the attack, and members of his social network who encouraged him and did not report his criminal intent.
Conspiracy to terrorism sounds like a very serious charge.
It is. Bear in mind, the crime is extremely serious. The assassin beheaded Samuel Paty right outside his high school. The difficulty being to prove that they knew of the intent, because most of them are saying that they either were expressing themselves freely online and or were just helping out a friend, not knowing that he had a terrorist plot in mind.
The idea of sort of spreading, whipping up misinformation, that is something that is, I guess, relatively new legally. Is that presenting, do you think, a particular challenge to prosecutors?
Yes, it does, because then again, you have to prove that the intent was murderous. What the prosecution is using is the background of this story, which is that just a month and a half before Samuel Paty's assassination, the newspaper Charlie Hebdo had republished cartoons, some of them depicting the Prophet Muhammad. And so what the prosecution is arguing is that those who were spreading online news knew that it would stir a violence that could lead to very tragic events. So what they're saying is that they were actually fueling violence that could not have any other outcome.
Anybody who heard about this around the world would have been appalled by it. What do you think? I mean, 4 years on, I know some schools have been named after Samuel Paty in tribute to him. What do you think has been the impact?
First of all, it sort of shown the vital role that teachers are playing in this very complex system of transmitting French core values to every citizen. It has also shown how those who can find fame in identity politics, bigotry and hatred were never taken down, even after the horrific Charlie Hebdo attacks. As you said, schools are now named after Samuel Paty. The problem is that on the 13th of October, 2023, Dominique Bernard, a French teacher, was stabbed to death by a 20-year-old refugee from Ingushetia who was self-radicalized online. Has everything changed? Not much. But what I can tell you is that in every classroom in France, a moment of silence was held for those two teachers, and then classes went on. The theme of that class was freedom of expression and the values of the Republic.
And that was the French journalist Alexandre Kouchner. You're with NewsHour. It's coming to you live from London with me, Tim Franks, and a little bit later in the programme we'll be rejoining James Kamarasamy in Wisconsin. In Israel, one story is dominating airwaves and newspapers. It's over a leak of classified information, information about Hamas's purported intentions, which was distorted, if not outright falsified, for political purposes. The claim is that it was used to hobble hostage negotiations, and which could implicate the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, himself. At least those are the allegations, and they've been fueled by a series of arrests. A fifth person has been detained today by the Israeli security services. Anshul Pfeffer is a biographer of Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israel correspondent for The Economist.
What has been gradually reported because of a gag order which has only been partially lifted is that there has been, for the last month, an investigation within the Israeli security establishment over the allegedly illegal collection of information from within Israel's military intelligence units by an aide of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. That information was later used in various leaks to both the Israeli and the international media.
And this person who has now been named, Eli Feldstein, what do we know about him?
In the first couple of weeks of the war in October 2023, he was appointed as a press officer in the Prime Minister's office with a specific brief to maintain contact with security reporters. You need obviously a certain level of security clearance to work in the Prime Minister's close team. He didn't pass that vetting. And despite that, he was still hired and for over a year was working quite closely with the Prime Minister.
Now, these documents that were then leaked to media outlets in Israel, but also notably in Germany and in Britain, these were stories that were subsequently discredited. But why were they sort of politically so sensitive at the time?
Well, for a start, we don't know that actual documents were passed on. From what we know so far, it's the purported content of documents, and in some cases, it seems that there were also fabrications which were passed on. Or the provenance of what was passed on was sexed up, presented as documents which came from Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas chief's computer, when they actually originated from much lower levels within Hamas. So what we do know is that this information, which was then reported by various news organizations, supported the position of Netanyahu not to agree to a ceasefire agreement with Hamas because of various intentions of Hamas. And this was used by Netanyahu himself in speeches back in September to justify his decisions.
There are others who have been detained as well, but we don't know their identities. How closely do we think Feldstein and possibly others are tied to the Prime Minister?
He worked in the Prime Minister's press operation. We don't know exactly how close they were. They probably weren't that close. Netanyahu doesn't have that many very close aides. We know that he was part of the team, and there's already photographs which have emerged of him with Netanyahu in various visits to military units. But from what I know, they weren't especially close.
Does that give the Prime Minister some cover, though? I mean, I noticed that there was a statement from Netanyahu's office saying that, contrary to false reports and misleading appearances portrayed in the media, no one from the Prime Minister's office has been questioned or detained.
Well, that statement is technically true because Feldstein was employed by the Director General of the Prime Minister's office and not by the Prime Minister's private office, as you would call it, probably in Britain. But the facts are that he was, over the past year, quite often in Netanyahu's inner circle. Netanyahu, as we know, is someone who is very involved in the media operations around him. It remains to be seen whether, in the questioning, Feldstein or other suspects have said that Netanyahu was involved. We just don't know that. He hasn't yet been mentioned as a suspect. He hasn't yet been questioned by police. He may not be.
Anshul Pfeffer, Israel correspondent for The Economist. More than a month on from the Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon, targeted Israel says at Hezbollah, the impact on the civilian population is clear. Many areas are deserted, with people forced to move to avoid the fighting. Our correspondent Orla Guerin has been in Nabatea, which, before the war, was one of the most heavily populated cities in southern Lebanon.
I'm standing in what is or was the old market area in Nabatea. It dated from the Ottoman era, and now there's really just destruction in every direction. And over our heads, very loud, very low in the sky, an Israeli drone. It's been there for the past 10 or 15 minutes, and it continues to hover. I'm with Hussein Jaber from the Civil Defence in Nabatea. You hear this all the time?
We hear it 90% of the time, but it depends exactly where it is. Now, we think it's right above us.
So they're watching us?
Most probably, yes. We don't care what they are watching. We care that we are here with our families and with every civilian in these difficult times.
Well, within the last few minutes, a patient has been rushed in, a woman. She's being treated here in the emergency department. You can hear now that she's in pain. She's a casualty of an airstrike that we heard just a few moments ago. Where is it? That's not. And a short time later, we heard this massive strike. The Israeli army says it's targeting Hezbollah, not the Lebanese people. We're inside the burns unit in the hospital. There are three patients here now, all victims of airstrikes. Lying in front of me is Mohammed, who's 29. He's a civil engineer. He has severe burns to his face. He has bandages around his chest where he has third-degree burns. And he was injured trying to bring food to a neighbour.
The airstrike hit the house right beside us. It was very close, about 5 meters away. It was all black, smoke everywhere. I took about 1 minute. Then I started to recognize what is around me, saw my friends, started talking to them, and I knew they were still alive.
And there was no warning before this strike?
No one, not at all. Not to us, not to our neighbors, not to the person inside the house that was hit.
The area that was hit, was this completely a civilian area?
All civilians, yes. The person who died actually is a policeman.
We're driving through Nabatea now. flattened, crushed buildings in every direction. Empty streets, boarded up shops. We've seen two people on the streets in the past hour. Everywhere there is broken glass, smashed shop fronts, rubble. It's been turned into a ghost city. And if and when people try to return, there'll be so much damage to repair.
And that was Orla Guerin reporting from southern Lebanon. One of the giants of American music has died today. Quincy Jones, band leader, composer, arranger and producer extraordinaire. He was 91. It's an overused word, but he really was a legend in the business. It'd probably be more useful now to talk about who he didn't work with, whose careers he didn't launch into the stratosphere. Ian Shaw is a British jazz singer who felt the force that was Quincy Jones back in 2006.
Well, I think I probably came across the force that was Quincy Jones when I heard It's My Party. It's my party, Leslie Gore. And unknowingly, as a child growing up in North Wales, you know, I heard things which, as a child, you don't bother to learn who wrote them, who arranged them. I was aware, subliminally, all my life, I suppose. To get an opportunity to meet and work with him later on would be an extraordinary thing that I would never have imagined.
Tell me what he was like when you did work with him. I mean, I guess, listen, by the time you did work with him, you were a pretty seasoned and successful musician. Yeah. But I mean, to come across somebody like that, were you feeling butterflies?
The thought of it was daunting because, you know, he is our sort of king, you know, Titan, a mega Titan in our world, in everyone's world, you know, in the film world, record world, in the activism world. Musically, as soon as I locked eyes with him, I knew that it was the music that was speaking, and that sort of breaks down all the barriers. And as soon as he started counting in the band in his purple Crocs on the stage, we were away. And it was just beautiful to see not just his connection to the music, but his connection with individual musicians on the stage. And he was very funny, very engaging, and there was no one else in the room when he was talking to you, and that's the sort of old style.
I mean, he could have been immune to what was going on around him or who was going on around him, because he had worked with absolutely everybody, hadn't he? I mean, not just worked with them, but also launched many of them.
Absolutely launched them as well. And also, he was a great nurturer. I was watching that beautiful documentary about We Are the World. And, you know, you see Diana Ross, Ray Charles, Dylan, Lionel Richie, Michael Jackson, all being sort of caressed and hugged by him in the room. And you saw their vulnerability as stars in a way. And he shot through that. He cut through that so beautifully and so sort of, I don't know, with a bit of a twinkle in his eye. The first thing I noticed about him actually was the twinkle in his eye. So he said, what's your name? And I said, my name's Ian. And he said, Ian? Oh, that's an unusual name. You know, he was very endearing and very funny. That was what Quincy was about. Elton John is the same. Elton John has the same connection and the same curiosity that is never going to go, you know. And that's what I loved about Quincy Jones. It made me certainly feel very, very important for the sort of 4.5 minute size on stage with him.
He cut across so many genres as well, didn't he? I mean, from jazz to pop to film to funk. It was just, yes. It was all one for Quincy Jones.
It was, because he only saw good music. Soul Bossa Nova is the, you know, the classic. I think that was in 1962. And then into, and Fly Me to the Moon. If you want to hear the sexiest, most brilliant, heart-stoppingly good swing, you listen to Fly Me to the Moon and that Count Basie band and his arrangement and the way he conducted it and the way he responded to Frank Sinatra as well, you know, at that point playing in the section. Just beautiful.
Frank Sinatra, Count Basie and a sprinkling of the genius that was Quincy Jones. That was Ian Shaw who was paying tribute to him. You're listening to NewsHour.
You're listening to NewsHour with Tim Franks in London and me, James Kamara-Sami, in Milwaukee. Welcome back to Solly's Grill, where there is a teeny-weeny butter burger with my name on it. Before that, though, we're going to look at one of the main issues in this election campaign, immigration. NewsHour has reported on how that's been playing out along the US-Mexico border, but it has also had an impact here in Wisconsin, 2,500 kilometres away. Over the past few years, nearly 1,000 undocumented migrants, mostly from Nicaragua and Venezuela, have arrived in Whitewater, a college town that's about an hour's drive from this city. Some people have raised the alarm about pressure on local schools, while the police chief wrote a letter to the White House asking for more resources. That all caught the eye of Donald Trump, who name-checked the town on the campaign trail.
Look no further than the small town of Whitewater, Wisconsin. Does anybody know Whitewater? After being inundated with Biden migrants, this tiny town now has a budget shortfall of over $400,000. Their public schools are straining with hundreds of new migrant students who don't speak a word of English. Their police force is being diverted from traffic stops to migrant crime, our favorite new term.
Well, I've been to Whitewater to see the impact of immigration on one small town that's become caught up in the national debate. At the homecoming parade in Whitewater, the local university's marching band, dressed in swing state purple, sashays down Main Street, followed by feathered mascot Willie Warhawk in the back of an open-top car. Among those watching this traditional celebration of the local football team, Councillor Brienne Brown. She's running for the Wisconsin State Assembly as a Democrat this year, but it was during a previous election campaign that she noticed how the town was changing.
During the pandemic, I was knocking on doors, and a lot of the housing that usually housed students, people speaking Spanish, were answering the doors. There's one guy from Venezuela and another few guys from Nicaragua, so we probably got 50 people here during the pandemic. But as chain migration happens, you get a good job and you have a roof over your head, you're going to send the word home, hey, this is a good place to live. So little by little, more people started showing up, and that's when the police started noticing right around 2021 was because it was a very, very cold day and they found a family living in a barn. And that's when they realized something was going on because they'd also started pulling over more immigrants who were in their cars, but they didn't have driver's licenses. So that's when they started realizing they did not have the resources to deal with some really minor infractions. And that's when it got really frustrating because instead of it being elected officials helping us with resources, it was elected officials turning it into a circus and wanting to discuss with the news how terrible Whitewater was.
People here feel about becoming this totemic town?
We're pretty angry about it. The majority of people here are very stoic and kind and would like to just make things work. And to have people throwing bombs at us, I mean, for instance, the first time this happened, neo-Nazis from Illinois came up to our university campus and put Nazi signs all over our campus. And they said on their Facebook page they did it because of the immigrants. Like, they are actually making us a target for people who don't even live here.
Good morning. My name is Henry Kinson. I grew up in Whitewater.
Henry is a local businessman and former school board member who gave evidence to the Republican-chaired House Judiciary Committee.
I was asked to come here to testify as to the educational situation in my hometown of Whitewater due to the large recent influx of non-English speakers.
At the Sweet Spot Cafe in that hometown, he told me what concerned him most.
There's a marked decline in educational outcomes, which kind of makes sense, right? I mean, if you have to spend more time translating to kids, you're going to have less favorable outcomes. The facts don't lie. This has nothing to do with race. It has to do with the fact that teachers have to deal with kids who don't speak English in the classroom with a bunch of kids who also do speak English. I have several friends who are teachers. It's a challenging situation. That's not a racial issue. It's an English issue.
And what impact has President Trump talking about this town had, do you think?
I think it's brought a focus on things that otherwise the city leaders didn't want. So I'm happy that Trump mentioned Whitewater because it forces Whitewater to admit that there are issues from the large number of immigrants, and then we can talk about how to deal with it instead of pretending that everything is great and the only people who have a problem with it are closet racists.
Do you think if President Trump is elected, then he will make a difference?
Well, he can't do worse. He can stop the influx. And at this point, I'd be happy for the bleeding to stop.
I've just entered the community space here in Whitewater. Just in front of me, there's a mountain of bagels being built on a table, all donations from a local store. A bright mural greets you. It says, "All are welcome here," in English and in Spanish. It's a place where members of the community, immigrants and others, can come and get free food, free household goods, free clothes, all of it donated. And there's also a classroom where English classes take place, and you can come here and get advice on immigration law.
I just had a woman come in with two bags of handmade mittens. She lives an hour away and brought us these mittens. What a godsend.
Kay Robers is the co-founder of the community space. She tells me that Donald Trump's comments about Whitewater have actually been helpful.
It's been wonderful because people are realizing that we're taking care of people and they want to be part of it. People are very generous with their donations.
This is the warehouse space at the back. Lots of people are bringing in donations, sorting them out. Among them is Pedro. He's been in the country for more than three decades. He helps out with the sorting, but also with the translation.
Today I helped one family. They was about a week here in the United States. They're looking for clothes for winter.
But as well as helping the new arrivals, Pedro says he's suffered because of their presence.
They see my color and my skin, and they stop me. The cop, they saw me.
He tells me he's been caught up in the police search for migrants driving without licenses. And for this Mexican-American, illegal immigration will be a key consideration when he votes.
Because we're working so hard and we pay taxes to help those people living in the hotels in Chicago, New York, not pay any penny. And we're working hard. They come from different country. I'm Mexico, but I think it's not right.
So you're a legal immigrant to this country and you are worried about people who are coming here illegally?
Yes. And Trump say they can stop that.
So you're leaning towards Trump?
A little bit.
But you will decide on the day? On Tuesday?
I wait till last minute.
As Whitewater comes together to celebrate its local football team, it's clear that the town is still grappling with the challenge of immigration, an issue that has thrust it into the national spotlight and could determine the outcome of Tuesday's election. So, just one more sleep until election day. We'll be bringing you all the coverage of that and of the results here on NewsHour. But for now, from Tim Franks in London and from me, James Kamara-Sami in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.